Let's go to our foreign affairs update from CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Brennan. She's also the moderator of Face the Nation Sundays on CBS. And I began by talking with Margaret about the recently passed foreign aid package, a lot of debate amongst lawmakers about that. And Margaret had this to say.
It was a minority who opposed it. Remember that what passed the House, these were all separate bills. In the Senate, they got squished together into one major package. And at least for Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he is taking a victory lap because he says, if you look at the vote count between what the aid package that passed back in the fall and the vote they just took this week, actually more Republicans have signed on. He got at least 9 more Senate Republicans on board with it. He cast that as a defeat of isolationism within the Republican Party on this issue of aid to Ukraine. But that is ignoring the J.D. Vances of the world, the senator from Ohio, who has made clear that he thinks the United States can only focus on one thing at a time and opposes Ukraine aid and is channeling more of this sort of populist point of view shared by Donald Trump, or at least publicly, it seems, shared by Donald Trump. There were also votes against this package in the Senate for those who were on moral basis objecting, as Bernie Sanders cast it, to the unfettered aid to Israel, that there were no strings attached to it whatsoever that would affect how the war in Israel that Israel is waging in Gaza is prosecuted. So there is still debate, but at the moment, the old line conservative Reagan Republicans are declaring victory.
Mitch McConnell taking that victory lap. Interesting, considering this was still months delayed, but you actually have him on the show this Sunday. What's that conversation going to consist of?
We do. And I taped it with him yesterday, and it was really fascinating because he did, as we're saying here, take that victory lap personally. He was so invested in getting this through, truly believed that the national security threats of Russia and China and Iran are all intertwined, since those adversaries are working together on different fronts in different conflicts, and is very much aligned with Joe Biden in that view that America has to stand up to it. Really fascinating that he has more of a shared worldview with Joe Biden on that front than with Donald Trump. He did take responsibility, and I was surprised at that, but he said this was absolutely a delay due to infighting within the Republican Party. He called it something like a family reunion in the end, where everyone was arguing with each other, but there were 4 months of delay in the Senate as they argued over whether or not to include this agreement on funding for the U.S. border, the southern border. And then ultimately, Senate Republicans dropped it, dropped their demand. And then it went to the House, and then they argued for a number of months over whether even to have the vote on aid to Ukraine. At the end of the day, they went ahead with it. But he did say that he personally apologized to Volodymyr Zelensky for it taking so long. Yes, so long. To get through Congress. And he had just hung up with Zelensky when he sat down with me.
We are talking with CBS moderator of Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. I wanted to ask more about the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell interview that will air this Sunday.
You know, Mitch McConnell has said that when he steps down from leadership, which he's expected to in November, that he will be more plain spoken. And you get a sense of that in the interview we do, where he is very passionate about this idea that America needs to go back to being the arsenal of democracy in terms of replenishing U.S. stockpiles with cutting edge weapons, which this aid package does, but also sending weapons to fight Russia so that American soldiers don't have to go there. He's a very big supporter of Israel. He's a very big supporter of helping Taiwan. So he very much believes in America trying to maintain its position of dominance on the world stage, something that is being actively debated within the two parties, frankly, about how robust a role the United States should play. But we don't know if that it will actually win the day. As he said on this one single vote, it did. But he did acknowledge what was helpful was Donald Trump agreeing to stop telling people to vote against Ukraine aid. So he hasn't convinced the leader of the Republican Party in many ways, the potential commander in chief, to come around to his worldview. And that is, that tells you the risk is out there as he sees it, that, you know, you could, if Donald Trump wins this election, have a president who is against the Zelensky regime and against Ukraine.
You talked a little bit about the concern over the unfettered access to this aid and weapons by Israel. How does that play into Israel's plans to invade the city of Rafah?
We still don't have the details or timeline for when that will play out. The aid that was given in this package has largely been described as about replenishing stockpiles for other fronts, other potential war fronts, including if things escalated along the northern border with Lebanese Hezbollah or potential conflict with Iran, rather than Gaza. But there are certainly Senate Democrats who raise objections, Bernie Sanders one of them, Chris Van Hollen another, who say it is the principle of the matter that if Israel doesn't address the human rights concerns, if they don't pull back on the humanitarian front in terms of the civilian casualties or allowing in more aid, that they shouldn't get more U.S. support at all. That it doesn't matter which conflict the weapons are given to, it seems like a U.S. blessing. That is their broader point. But at the end of the day, they voted to pass this package. So those objections were really put to the side.
I saw President Biden on social media holding a little girl, one of the hostages released by Hamas. Is this an indication that he feels these conversations are going forward and more hostages can be released soon?
We are going to give you the latest on what we see. We know that the Secretary of State may be headed back to the region soon. We know that the diplomacy to get the hostages out has largely been stalled to date. The CIA director said as much last week. But the White House has been briefing and indicating that they actually do want to find some diplomatic way forward here. They are stuck with the commander of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, in the war zone, refusing to negotiate on certain points, and they're stuck. We don't know on the Rafah invasion where those negotiations are between the United States and Israel, but the Biden administration has been imploring them to share their plans and to really try to minimize impact. There's also on the U.S. side the hope that they might be able to disperse some of the people who are concentrated in southern Gaza in that Rafah area so that they're not massacred in the crossfire. And keep in mind, there are still U.S. citizens there and there are still foreign citizens there. And so that is very much a diplomatic concern at this moment.
This Sunday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Face the Nation, also the UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell, Margaret Brennan. She's the moderator of Face the Nation. We appreciate your time, Margaret.
Thank you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell, he joins us every Friday for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, they rarely make it onto maps or in the signage out front, but Seattle has its fair share of buildings with well-known nicknames.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, good morning. I like organic names for things, you know, where there's no focus group or marketing people or just, you know, just some wise guy or gal comes up with a clever free-range nickname for something. We've talked about this before with cities and neighborhoods and everything. The somethings for today's purposes are buildings in downtown Seattle, and all the examples we'll talk about are inspired by the way the building looks. Now, we've talked before about this building the Space Needle came in. That's a well-known one. That's the old Seafirst Bank Tower, which was built in 1968. That nickname was in print, I think, by 1969. The place is called Safeco Plaza officially nowadays, but a lot of people still call it the building the Space Needle came in. Now, here's a few more.
But why?
It's this big box.
Okay.
It was built after the Space Needle, which Dave pointed out when we talked about this. The chronology doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
But it's this big box, and it was the first big skyscraper in the late 60s.
I've never heard that.
Okay. Now, the first one, I'm going to say a few of these. I'll say the nickname. You tell me where it is or what it is. Try and guess. It'll be like a game show, okay?
Oh, boy.
Tom, you can join in, too.
Chris, why, thank you.
Yeah, everybody. We're going to get, okay, all right. First one is what inspired me to do the topic. I read the other day in the Seattle Times that a loan is coming due on developer Martin Selig's portfolio of downtown Seattle properties, which includes the Darth Vader building. Hmm. Cricket noise.
Is that no idea.
Seattle Library?
No, this is the 4th and Blanchard building right there. It's got the very pointy, sharp edges.
Oh, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
And the location's in the name, 4th and Blanchard building.
Okay.
Star Wars, of course, came out in 1977. That building was built in 1979. And it was actually, by February of 81, that name was already being used in print. So it caught on pretty soon. Okay, here's an easy one. The sinking ship.
Yeah, it's really easy.
Cricket noise. Who are these people? Why? What has happened to Colleen and Tom and Sully? Where did you guys?
A sinking ship.
It's a parking garage on 2nd Avenue across from the Smith Tower. You guys have never heard that? Am I insane?
No.
Okay.
No, you're not insane. It's interesting.
Let's go to a commercial.
I don't get downtown much.
How's traffic looking, Sully?
I don't know. What's the building with the walrus tusks on it?
The sinking ship parking garage is across from the Smith Tower. It's built on the side of the old Seattle Hotel, which was damaged in the earthquake 75 years ago. It's tipped up at an angle.
There before going to the clubs.
It has a bow that points up in the air. So it looks like, was built in 1961. I don't know what it was originally officially called, but by the early 70s, they were calling that in print. And I thought everyone knew it was called the Sinking Ship Parking Garage. And actually, Diamond Parking now calls it the Sinking Ship Garage.
They have embraced
the nickname, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, this one. No one's going to know this one, probably. I think the view of this building is gone. You used to be able to see it from the viaduct. It was built in 1991 and called the Ban Roll-On Building. exactly.
Because it looks like a deodorant.
Thank you, Nick.
It's great to be on today's final installment of All Over the Map with Felix Spinell. Folks, it's been a great run. Isn't he wonderful? Let's hear this one here. Here's a banker's box with all of your belongings. No.
What I love is you're teaching us something, Felix.
Right.
So that's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe we shouldn't have turned this into a game show.
Let's have the text people confirm that I'm not insane. Well, we ask that all the time. But it's called the 2nd and Seneca Building. It was built in 1991, and it was called the Ban Roll-On Building because the top is kind of round. Looks like the ball in an old roll-on container.
You're right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The name was in print by the year it opened. It was embraced right away. But again, the viaduct view is gone, so I don't think you see the name anymore.
Sixth time's a charm, is that?
All right, here's a weird one here. We're getting into the more esoteric ones. I should have done this the other direction, I think. But I'll come back and do this in the 7 o'clock hour. We'll pretend like we know all these. Okay, here's one. The twin toasters are just the toasters. Cricket noise again. Good. Metropolitan Park Towers along the freeway there. They're called the Metropolitan Park East, Metropolitan Park West. Okay. And most of these were in print by 1993 in a column my old pal Jean Godden did.
Oh, yeah.
So she was, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and Jean's about 1,000 feet tall as far as I'm concerned. Okay. You used to work for this company. I think both of you did.
Yeah.
The washer and dryer.
Fisher Plaza?
Before Fisher Plaza, there was a Como building, two Como buildings there, one built in the 40s, one built in the 70s, and people called it the washer and dryer. They're very plain-looking boxes.
Right.
I heard Brian Johnson call it that about 20 years ago.
Brian Johnson?
I'm Brian Johnson. he called it. Then it was in print, though. Emmett Watson called it that in a column back in the 1970s. Mm. Let's do a couple backwards ones now because they're weird. I don't want to say the names on the air because it's a family show.
Oh.
All right, the AT&T Tower, which is now the Seattle Metropolitan Tower. Anybody have any ideas of the anatomical look of that one? Nope. Cricket noise, please. Very good. Okay, and the Rainier Tower had also a name that isn't exactly anatomical, but it could be construed that way, but it was in print by 1978. Can I have cricket noise again, please?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say those, but I want our listeners, our more chronologically endowed listeners, to tell me. They know the answer.
Somebody wrote, Kristen and Bothell said, the pencil building. Do you know
that
one?
That's the Rainier Tower. That's one of the names. But there's another name for it that nowadays would be kind of like people would snort
and
chuckle if we said the name.
One person said they know the Ban Roll-On Building.
See, I love our listener.
Crowd is out there, Felix.
I think we're going to dump my regular music. Just play the cricket noise every time I come on now.
Okay, sounds good.
Do you have your weekend plans made? If not, Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden has you covered.
It's Friday then, it's Saturday, Sunday, what? It's Friday then, it's Saturday, Sunday, what?
That time yet again. The weekend is here and we got lots going on in the region. If you're looking for a chance to volunteer, the Downtown Everett Association is holding its 5th annual planting day on Saturday. Volunteers are needed to help plant 3,000 flowers and over 270 planters throughout downtown Everett. You can get details at downtowneverettpartners.org. If you have some hard to recycle items at home taking up space, things like styrofoam, electronics, household batteries, fluorescent light bulbs, and more, you can recycle them at the Evergreen State Fair Park in Moreau on Saturday from 10 to 2. You'll want to look for the red lot. There's also going to be food served as well, so a great way to clean out the house. This weekend, it's the 5th annual Grandma Conference. The Seattle Gambian Grandma Association is putting on the event Saturday at the Washington West African Center Hall in Lynnwood. There will be panels as well as refreshments. You can get more details at wawac.org.
This is what it is, okay? I said, empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water.
Are you familiar with the term Bruceploitation? According to the Grand Illusion Cinema, within hours of Bruce Lee's funeral, Hong Kong movie studios began to produce hundreds of unauthorized biopics, sequels, prequels, spin-offs, and rip-offs starring a complete series of Bruce Lee lookalikes. Over the next decade, fueled by both deception and demand, Bruceploitation would become a staple of global cinema. The Grand Illusion Cinema is showing a new documentary exploring Bruceploitation called Enter the Clones of Bruce on Saturday and Sunday, as well as a couple of famous Bruce Lee spin-off movies. Get details at grandillusioncinema.org. At the Cornish Playhouse, it's the Creative Works pop-up market in Flatstock 94. It's your chance to be around creative people, as that's the whole idea, sharing your creative side. There are presentations, panels, and networking opportunities. And if you want to support some of the artists or get some new art, there's an open-to-the-public market. And according to Creative Works, they have teamed up with the American Poster Institute to bring you Flatstock 94 on Friday and Saturday at the Cornish Playhouse from 10 to 6. You can see prints and shops from poster artists from all across the globe. The Upper Left Comedy Festival is underway in Belltown. This weekend-long event will be highlighting not only some of the funniest stand-up comedians from the Pacific Northwest, but some acts from around the country as well. There are a few venues with different lineups, so get tickets and plan ahead by checking out upperleftfest.com. The Mariners are back in town this weekend, taking on the Arizona Diamondbacks. Old friend Eugenio Suarez will be taking the field for the D-backs, and there is a special promo night for each game this weekend. Turn ahead the clock. Jersey night is tonight, 90s night is tomorrow, and Little League Day is Saturday. You might have to deal with the little rain, but no worries when there's a roof, right? This is just a sample of what's going on in the region this weekend. If you know of stuff going on in your area that I gotta know about, let me know at paulh@cairoradio.com. Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
Light Rail is finally coming to the east side. The starter line between South Bellevue and the Microsoft campus in Redmond opens to the public Saturday. Cairo News Radio's Nate Connors was one of the first to catch a ride on the line. He sat down with fellow traffic reporter Mickey Gomez to talk about the experience.
For the very first time in Seattle history, Nate Connors rode a light rail.
True that. Yeah, first time in my life, actually.
That's the breaking news.
Right, right.
No, I'm just kidding. No, the Bellevue Redmond two line, is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, yeah, the link line, the two line link, something like that. Call it what you want. Just put a two in there and you'll be good to go, because then you don't confuse it with the one line. It's the east side link.
Yeah, the east side link. So it was supposed to launch in 2020. Pandemic hit. Then we had the concrete issues.
Yeah.
Then, you know, 2023, we were thinking it's going to open, but no. And then 2024.
Mm-hmm.
So this Link Line 2, the East Link,
yes,
opens on Saturday to the public.
That's right. Absolutely. Downtown Bellevue, the station there. And actually, you know what, to add to that is, you know, part of the plans was to connect this with the I-90 crossing link, right, to link the two. But they didn't want to wait for that, because that obviously got delayed, too.
Mm-hmm.
So Councilwoman Claudia Balducci was a very force in getting this East Link up and running earlier than that. Otherwise, we would wait another year.
Yeah, because the Seattle across the lake connection, Seattle to Bellevue, is supposed to launch in 2025. Fingers crossed, correct?
Correct.
So what was the atmosphere like? You get to Bellevue and you're about to ride this for the first time.
Well, for one, it was the media tour, so everyone's just pumped and happy and psyched to be there. But more importantly, it was just good to see the council people there and the mayor of Bellevue and many of the employees, from guards to just people who help you on and off the trains, to even some of the operators were there too, to talk to them. Everyone's just excited, and it's good to see that, you know, because you oftentimes you hear some bad news about the one line around Seattle area, but the two line, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And a part of it is that the Bellevue Police Department is going to be on there.
Yeah, Sully talked to Bellevue Police.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have what, 5 officers?
Mm-hmm.
At any given time, and possibly even expand that unit to ensure that what happens here in Seattle on the one line doesn't happen in Bellevue.
True that. And importantly, on top of that, there's only 4 trains, 2 going each way. So 5 cops is plenty. And they've already got security at all of the stops already. Transit police, if you will.
And so they're not going to be checking tickets. They're strictly there to ensure that crimes aren't committed.
That's it. They're going to make sure crime is, crime is out there. But I think their own words is, we're going to bring down crime as much as we can. And, you know, just knowing that police officers are on board, I would think from a criminal mind, you're not going to go on there and commit any crimes, right?
So what did you think when you were on the train? I mean, did it have the new train smell?
It did, actually. Yeah, like a new car smell.
Yeah.
So it was cool being one of the first, shoes on the floor in there, if you will. And on top of that, you're in Bellevue. There's a lot of cool views. Just sitting in the train, watching all the views as you go through. You go through a couple dark tunnels.
What was it like going through the tunnel?
Well, it was really quick and fast. I mean, this train gets going. You know, it's only 90 seconds between each stop. So once it gets going, you're bam, you're there. I think there's six, seven, eight stops along the 6.5 mile length. And they're all really quick. So it's really cool. I enjoyed the views. And my favorite part, I kind of found myself smiling, is when you're above the freeway and you're looking down at bumper-to-bumper traffic and you're going, ah, suckers, I'm not in that traffic. You know, I'm scooting all through that.
Yeah, no kidding. I imagine so. What was it like being like at grade level, you know, mm-hmm. with the cars? And cars were like, people, could you see people in their cars watching you as the Link Light Rail 2 drove by?
I couldn't really see the drivers too much because, you know, they're moving and we're moving. So you can't really get a great look at each other. But, you know, you can just see that you're not stopping at red lights. You're not stopping at bumper-to-bumper traffic. You're just cruising from point A to point B. And they're going to move people off these trains pretty quickly. Like I said, they've got employees there to guide people on and off to make sure people are moving and not just standing around clogging up and delaying the trips.
What did a councilwoman have to say about the launch of this? I mean, it's a long time coming.
Right. Well, you nailed it. She talked about how proud she was at... since 2005 is when she first brought this link up in the east side, and it's been an uphill battle for a majority of that. She put it in a nice way. She said, we adopted our kid when the kid was three. She didn't say boy or girl, so I don't know. She just said kid. We adopted our kid when our kid was 3 years old, and our kid is now a senior in high school and is just now getting completed. So she says she's been working diligently all that time. And she went from a Bellevue council member to a King County council member, and the whole time has always fought for this. And she's the important link, like I said earlier, who got this running at least a year early. They're not waiting for that I-90 bridge to connect.
Which isn't going to hopefully happen until next year.
Yeah, right.
Now, if we could just have the whole, you know, Federal Way to Tacoma extension.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. And then another thing on top of these stops here, there's two more stops that are going to connect into Redmond here in the next couple of years, including Marymore Park in the summertime. That's a great link for families and then also concerts. So this is a great link for the east side.
That is Nate Connors and Mickey Gomez, part of Sully's traffic team, talking about the new 2 line coming to the east side tomorrow is open to the public.
Yeah, 10 a.m. ribbon cutting at the downtown Bellevue station, which is right there at City Hall. And matter of fact, that's where it pops out of the tunnel. It pops out right there on the north side of City Hall. So it's kind of cool. And then service begins at 11 o'clock tomorrow. So if you want, and they're going to have a bunch of fun events like at every stop along the way. They're having little events and things for kind of make a day out of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see what Nate saw. You know, I'm going over the top of I-5 or 405 there and just kind of tooling around because there are some pretty cool views over there mm-hmm. on the train. So
and
I'm
how
excited.
How nice to be on a fresh, crispy Sound Transit Link light rail train.
Yeah, the new train smell, new. As they said. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious, as a Snohomie, when are we getting our light rail?
Well, technically, August.
August to Linwood.
To Linwood.
Okay.
But that's Snohomish County.
That's
No.
That's nothing,
you know,
that, to
that's going
to
be a big deal because, you know, for those of us, like, remember last year I did my whole, I'm taking light rail to a Mariners game and what that turned into because I drove down to Northgate, couldn't find parking, drove, you know, whatever. Well, now I've got another stop to the north with a big old parking garage there in Linwood where I might be able to do that.
Well,
and
don't
then
forget
catch
Mount Lake Terrace.
Well, true, but Mount Lake Terrace, the parking garage isn't as big, but it's still pretty big.
Yeah, I feel like they opened more spots, maybe not
they
in
might
the
have.
Garage, but in a surface parking area. It's pretty expansive.
Yeah,
there.
So there's spots up there. So for those of us who are a little bit further north, we don't have to go all the way to Northgate. So that'd be great. Problem is, you know, it's not going to get up into the, you know, to downtown Everett. We're talking the 40s, 2040s.
Oh.
So.
And that's who needs it. I mean, I grew up in Marysville, right? And so the commute from Marysville to Seattle just feels forever.
Right. Because you run into two different sets of slowing getting through Marysville and then And so, yeah, so that's going to be a good one. Linwood, we're still behind on Federal Way. We're looking at 25 there. They ran into issues with the soil.
Yeah.
They're south of the airport where they thought they could put go at grade. Then they thought they could kind of build on top of the grade, but it just kept sinking. And now they're building a bridge. Mm-hmm. So that's put that behind a 25. They're still on target to get across the lake sometime next year across I-90, and that'll be the huge deal.
Okay.
That was my question.
Because I was going to ask you about the impact on traffic. How much can this really have an impact? I feel like once it gets across the lake, that's when we'll see it the most.
Yeah. And again, it was never really designed to make traffic better. It was always designed and pitched as a way to give other people an option other than being in their car. Oh. Will it have an impact? Certainly. But once it gets across the lake, it opens up other different people that commute. I mean, you can come in from Woodinville if you wanted to, park at the South Bellevue Garage, which has 1,500 spaces, mm-hmm. and then catch it across the lake and then catch it, or eventually get it up in Redmond. And that'll eventually, I think, really start having an impact once it goes somewhere.
So modern and so proud
of
our
city. So 1996 when Portland launched theirs, launched the Max.
We're doing it, guys. This station has given Sound Transit so much grief. Let's celebrate the little victories.
Yeah, let's take the little, and trust me, I know they're way over budget, way behind schedule. Trust me, we know all that, but you're right. Something positive is happening. Go check out the East Link the starter line. See what it's like. Experience it. See where you can go, can't go, and get those great views Nate talked about.
Charlie, I have to say, I agree with our news director. The Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A woman in Arkansas who helps unsheltered, newly divorced individuals struggling to start a new life after addiction. Stella Lancaster has helped people get furniture, presents for Christmas, food for the end of the month. Nani Zavala said to local station K8 that Stella helped her family when their truck broke down and they stayed in town.
She was the reason my children had Christmas the first year. She was the reason my family didn't starve, literally.
Lancaster is a mother and grandmother who spends her days helping people who are struggling, sometimes at the end of their rope.
In Region 8, there's like a big disconnect, I think, and this is like somebody actually sewing up holes.
I'm grateful for Stella, for she'll take anything in that anybody has.
Lancaster works daily to keep her Facebook site called Free Resources and Help updated with all kinds of valuable information for those needing help. People contact her with needs, and she tries her very best to fill all of them.
I enjoy doing it. If I see somebody post something on, then I'll start investigating it.
Her children are now grown, and she's a grandmother who finds her greatest joy in life taking care of family and friends, thousands of them online. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has opened an investigation into Tesla's recall that aimed to get drivers to pay better attention when their vehicles are in autopilot. Jeff Gilbert covers the auto industry for WWJ Radio in Detroit.
Investigators say the software update may not remedy the problem, as it requires owners to opt in and even allows them to reverse it. This comes as there have been crashes involving autopilot even after the update. 2 million Teslas are involved.
Reporter Jeff Gilbert says it's too early to tell if a second recall will be needed, but we just had a deadly crash involving a Tesla in autopilot. The fiance of the man killed is going after Tesla.
It's ironic that what is considered to be one of the most safe vehicles that has the best features that can protect somebody would take someone's life.
On April 19th, just 1 week ago, Janae Hutchinson, a mother of three, says the man she was engaged to, 28-year-old Jeffrey Neeson, was riding his motorcycle when State Patrol says the driver of a Tesla in autopilot ran over him, pinning him under the vehicle, and he died at the scene. Troopers say the Tesla driver told them he was distracted by his phone.
Because of someone being distracted, he's gone, and I don't get to have him.
Tesla's website says autopilot is only to be used with a fully attentive driver. Hutchinson says that's not enough and is calling on Tesla to make safety upgrades. The driver was arrested for vehicular homicide. Locally, there have been other serious crashes involving Teslas in autopilot as well. And Cairo 7 TV reports 3 years ago on Highway 2 in Gold Bar, a woman suffered a broken shoulder when a Tesla in autopilot crashed into her parked vehicle at a grocery store. And a
attorney for the David Law Group that specializes in vehicle crashes, says autopilot crashes are not common and there are no specific laws in Washington state that deal with this type of incident, at least not yet. And it's not just Tesla under scrutiny. Cairo 7 TV's Jesse Jones investigated a claim that a flaw in certain Subaru Outbacks can cause the vehicle to suddenly accelerate.
A Subaru Outback smashed in Shoreline.
It was life or death for me. I mean, it happened that fast.
Another Outback annihilated in Arizona.
While I'm waiting for my garage door to go up. And it took off.
And this Forester's mangled in Massachusetts.
It went up over and it with such force it flipped me on my side.
All three drivers blame Subaru for the crashes. The cause, they say?
I know that it was an unintended acceleration. It was with such force.
Cheryl and a dozen other plaintiffs are suing Subaru. The 2020 proposed class action lawsuit claims the automaker knew that the class vehicles contained one or more defects that caused sudden and unintended acceleration without driver input. Do you believe Subaru knew this was an issue and kept selling these cars?
Subaru has known since 2011 of this issue, and they've known it from complaints by customers directly to Subaru and to its dealers as well, and from information passed on from the dealers and also through pre-release testing that Subaru did.
Russell Paul represents the plaintiffs in this case. The Subarus listed in the lawsuit represent more than 144,000 vehicles potentially on Washington's roadways. So they've known about this for a while. That's what you're saying.
We have alleged that they have.
The lawsuit says there were more than 200 complaints filed to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration about sudden unintended acceleration. In a statement, a spokesperson for Subaru says, Subaru of America takes safety very seriously, and we are not aware of a single confirmed case of unintended acceleration in a Subaru vehicle. When reviewing cases with the event data recorder data, the results invariably show that the vehicle driver pressed the accelerator pedal instead of the brake pedal.
But we dispute that. We've spoken to many, many of the class members. We've heard them testify under oath of their experiences, and we've analyzed their crash data. And we've also recreated through computer simulation models the incidents that occurred. And we believe they are clear expressions of unintended acceleration.
And there is more to this investigation by Cairo 7 TV's Jesse Jones. You can find the entire story at Cairo7.com. Right now, a voice you all recognize, consumer man Herb Weissbaum. Data breaches of medical records hit a record high last year. The enormous amount of personal information compromised in these breaches, not only a threat to patient privacy, but it's fueling an increase in identity theft. So Herb is a contributing editor at checkbook.org. Also a buddy of ours. So Herb, what can you tell us about this?
Well, good morning. This is a growing problem and a serious one. Based on government data, it's estimated that the health records of at least 133 million people, about one in three Americans, were compromised last year, Colleen. Hackers are drawn to these medical files, especially hospital records, because they're such a treasure trove of useful information that they can use in a variety of ways for their crimes. They aren't interested in learning about your medical conditions. They're looking for financial information, such as social security numbers, medical record account numbers, health insurance policy numbers, all information that can help them commit all sorts of identity theft.
So who's in charge of keeping your information safe?
Well, basically, the people who collect it are required by law to keep it safe. But this is such an inviting target because there's so much information here, and the companies that hold this may not be as secure with their data policies as many other companies that are out there. So in a minute, we're going to talk about some things that you can do to protect yourself. But I want to share with you, so many things can happen when a thief gets your medical information. They can commit other types of fraud. They can get medical goods in your name. They can rip off insurance companies, file false claims in your name. They can get durable medical equipment in your name, prescription drugs in your name. And I spoke for the Checkbooks Consumerpedia podcast to Eva Velasquez. She is president and CEO of the nonprofit Identity Theft Resource Center in San Diego. And I want you to listen to this personal story she shared about a medical ID theft victim who contacted them.
We had a woman who was a victim of medical identity theft, had her identity misused to get medical services. but also prescriptions. So she was dealing with mixed medical records where she had improper diagnoses within her medical records that she had to clean up. She was dealing with her insurance provider trying to prove to them that I did not receive those, and she had to go through that issue of proving that to them. But with the prescriptions, what ended up happening was because it was for narcotics, it triggered law enforcement intervention because it was of many, many different pharmacies all in the same region. She not only had to deal with all of the medical issues and was unable to get prescriptions that she needed for her own medical care, but now law enforcement was investigating her for a crime and she had to deal with that. And she didn't learn about that until they actually came to her home to issue an arrest warrant, went to her children's schools, pulled them out of school, and put them in the custody of Child Protective Services.
Wow.
It was absolutely devastating for her. And she did nothing. She was not a party to any of this. She did absolutely nothing wrong. But all of the burden fell on her to prove that she wasn't engaging in this behavior. Again, to the point where she had to deal with the criminal justice system in addition to her insurance provider and her healthcare provider.
That's insane, Herb. That has to be a real outlier in these cases. Not everyone is investigated as a criminal just because their ID is taken.
No, of course not. But that shows you the damage that can happen if your ID is stolen. Another example, Eva, from the ITRC gave me was, and I've dealt with this in interviewing victims before, is that somebody gets medical treatment in your name and that information gets commingled with your medical record. So she said, for instance, what happens if somebody has appendix removed and it gets in your file and you show up at the hospital and you have symptoms of appendicitis, but their file says appendix removed, that might slow down the proper treatment. Years ago spoke to a teenager in another state who wanted to give blood. There was a big car accident with a lot of kids involved. They were all donating blood. She shows up to donate blood and they say, sorry, you can't donate. You have AIDS. And she goes, I don't have AIDS. And they said, no, it's right here on your record. Somebody had gotten AIDS treatment in another state, had got commingled with her record. It took her parents a month or two to get that straightened out. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that can happen. Some serious consequences can result from this.
And I know you're not just here to scare us. You're here to tell us what to do to protect ourselves.
Well, yes. And again, you know, you're not in control of your data. Your healthcare providers are, and we're encouraging them. And some of them are actually stepping up to the plate with the huge breaches that have taken place to improve their security. But they have vendors upon vendors upon vendors. You know, the hospital may not be billing you. It may be another company. Somebody else may be processing the payment. So here's what you can do. Read your explanation of benefit statements. You know, the information from your health insurance that says, here's the kind of services you've gotten. And it says, this is not a bill, so you ignore it and throw it away. Please don't ignore it and throw it away. Just skim it. You know, if you see that you had a kidney removed in Cleveland and you still have both kidneys, you've never been in Cleveland, or you're all of a sudden taking a narcotic drug that you're not taking, that's a pretty good indication that you're a victim of medical identity theft and you need to do something about it. Review your medical records throughout the year. If you're going online on your online portal, check your records, what conditions have been diagnosed, what prescriptions are listed, past and upcoming appointments. If there's anything wrong, again, take action. If you do use an online portal, use strong and unique passwords for all those medical accounts. You know, thieves are happy to hack into a big database, but if you make it easy for them, password 123, they may just hack into your account and steal your information. And limit what you carry around with you in your purse or your wallet. If you don't need that card, a debit card that links to your health spending account or the card that links to your Medicare Advantage account, don't take it with you. Only take it with you when you go to the drugstore or the doctor's office. Again, they'd be very happy. Criminals like the lowest risk and the lowest effort way of stealing information. So just, you know, that's how you can somehow limit your information, see if there's a problem, and maybe deal with it.
In recent years, I've been very careful about the information I put down on paper documents. You know, you'll be handed a health form because you're a volunteer and they want your insurance number and they want your prescriptions you're taking and the things you suffer from. And I've gone, I don't think you need all that information. And I don't hesitate to do that on digital medical records, but it sounds like I should be. And number two, can I really leave out that information on a digital medical record too?
Sometimes you can. I mean, the goal is always to give less information when possible. You know, for certain things, if you're trying to do something with, you know, your Medicare, your insurance, your doctor's office, you know, they're going to use, in most cases, either a Social Security number or your medical ID number. They've got to identify you somehow. So there's going to be certain information that you need to provide. You need to make sure you're on the right portal, that you're going to the right place. By the way, you mentioned medical paper records. That has just skyrocketed this crime, because in the old days, they had to get either break into a doctor's office and steal some records, have somebody on the inside, or do the old fashioned. Remember, we talked about dumpster diving in the old days?
Oh, yeah.
They would go to the old dumpster and steal the stuff. Well, now, because all the records are digitized and they're in the cloud, all they have to do is figure out a way to break into the cloud, whether that's, you know, a phishing attack or going to, like I said, the provider of the provider of the provider that has a link into the hospital, but isn't the hospital, and they can snag all those records in one fell swoop. It has made it so much easier to suck up so many records. It really is incumbent. And, you know, the government's passed some laws to make it stricter. There are fines that can be invoked by the government if these hospitals and medical providers lose our information. Of course, that doesn't do much good once the information's lost. I asked the ITRC people, the identity theft resource people, how valuable this data is, just sort of put it in monetary terms, because that's how we compare things. They told me that a working credit card number is probably worth $25 to $30 when it's being sold on the dark web, which is where criminals, you know, buy and sell all this information they steal. They said a good working prescription drug number, so they could buy drugs in your name, probably worth $100. That gives you an idea of what the money involved is and why they're shifting to medical data breaches, because there's just so darn much money involved.
This is necessary information, and you can hear all of Herb's full report. Read it at checkbook.org. Herb, thank you once again.
Thanks, Colleen. Have a great weekend.
You too. Let's get our baseball update with Tom Hutler here and Rick Riz on the line. Producer David Burbank called up the voice of the Seattle Mariners, Rick Riz, to find out what's happening with the team. And David, what'd you find out?
Yeah, that's right, Colleen. And that is the first place Seattle Mariners for the moment. At least first place in our division, we'll say. The team just came off a 6-game road trip in Denver and then in Arlington. They won 2 of 3 games in each of those series. And so I wanted to ask Rick what he saw in each of those.
Well, David, I saw a ball club that just continues the roll on the pitching side. Their starting pitching is the best in the American League, the best in baseball, and these guys just continue to roll out 5-plus, 6-plus, pitching into the 7th inning, quality innings. I mean, just shutting down the offense of the Rockies and Colorado and the Rangers, you know, in their ballpark, where it was really tough to win a ballgame last year. As a matter of fact, the Mariners were 0-6 last year. Going into that series, they hadn't won a game there since August of 2022, but a different story this year. And I also saw an offense that is starting to really come around. They're hitting the ball out of the ballpark. That's how they won game one with a pair of 2-run home runs. That's how they won yesterday with a pair of 2-run home runs. Certain guys are really starting to get going. We saw Ty France hit his first home run of the year. And that came at an opportune time, right away in the top of the first inning, opposite field home run to give the Mariners a 2-0 lead. So I'm seeing a ball club with a lot of new players, a lot of new faces, really coming together as a team.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that, you know, you see guys like Ty France and Julio, who had his first home run this last week, which was an absolute moonshot, which was really nice to see.
Yeah.
I think it's important for both of them to be stepping up as leaders on the team, because, of course, we got the sad news this week of J.P. Crawford now on the injury list. What do we know about his injury? What does he bring to the team? What's sort of absent now that he's going to be on the injury list?
Yeah, that's a tough loss for the Mariners. J.P. Crawford, if you ask Scott Service, he was the MVP of the ball club last year. There's no question that Julio Rodriguez is the best player on this team. But J.P. Crawford, what he did after starting the year hitting 9th and then going all the way up to the leadoff spot, that's when the ball club really took off last year and almost made it to the playoffs, you know, by just one win. His defense, his presence, the way he grinds out every at bat, he's one of the greatest competitors that I've seen on this ball club and in this organization in a long, long time. He just wants to win every night, and it really shows. So a strained oblique is a tough injury to come back from. It usually takes a while. They're not saying how long he's going to be back. Right now he's on the 10-day IL with a strained right oblique, but usually that takes a few weeks. Hopefully it doesn't take as long, but we'll have to wait and see. Now, in the meantime, Dylan Moore has done a tremendous job for this team. Now he's going to be out there seeing a lot of playing time at shortstop. He's swinging a really good bat, So in the meantime, Dylan Moore will be there and he'll be just fine.
So coming up now, we've got a big homestand, 6 games at T-Mobile Park. First very important series against the Arizona Diamondbacks starting today. We're going to see some familiar faces kind of in both of these series. What makes this Diamondbacks team kind of special to the Mariners specifically?
Well, right now, you know, the Diamondbacks come in. They're the reigning National League champions. They made it to the World Series last year. So when you get that far, you know, with a pretty young ball club last year, they got Corbin Carroll on the team, a kid who grew up here in Seattle watching the Mariners, went to Lakeside High School. Now you come in with a lot of confidence. So it's going to be a big series. Mariners are definitely ready for it. They've got the momentum going into the series tonight. And we just want to remind everybody that tonight, opening game of the series with the Diamondbacks, it's going to be a Mariners turn ahead the clock jersey night. That's always a lot of fun. We've got 90s night, a Mariners neon hat night coming up tomorrow, and also Little League Day on Sunday the 28th. Always great to see all the kids at the ballpark. And then later on, our first Bark of the Park night. So it's going to be a big crowd. Hope to see you at T-Mobile Park tonight. It's going to be a lot of fun.
That is the voice of the Mariners, Rick Riz. He will join us every Friday, interviewed by David Burbank, one of the biggest Mariners and Rick Riz fans around.
It still feels like I'm in a dream when I'm talking to him. I love it.
And he's, you've been cool sitting guy next to Tom Hutler for how, I mean, it's like you as a little Mariners fan.
For
kid,
months
you're
now,
like, oh,
believe
my gosh
me, the first time sitting next to Tom, I was like, oh,
he
my
was shaking
goodness.
He was so nervous and excited. Awesome. It was very cute. The Mariners game, it can be heard on our sister station, 710 Seattle Sports, and on Sundays, you can hear the games right here on 97.3 Cairo FM.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.